All right. I'll talk now, I guess. Y'all want talking? I'll talk at you here. Today on the show, Steve Horn, whose article I'm rereading right now. I read it the other day, but I read it on my phone. Boy, this thing's long, man. Oops. I'm gonna have to go back during the commercial and finish up. Steve Horn will be on. He's got the number of a Democratic peace activist. Not a peace activist, a nonviolent social change activist guy who actually is just a rat for Stratfor. Or maybe he's not just a rat for Stratfor. Maybe now he's a rat for Stratfor. So this guy, he's a rat for Stratfor. I don't know enough. But Steve Horn, he knows. Journalist from Madison, Wisconsin. And he's got a co-author too, Carl Gibson. And they actually have a follow-up piece, which is refuting someone who has attempted to refute them. I'm too lazy to have a big debate on the show and whatever, but I like Steve, and we're going to hear his side of it anyway, and I'll tell you where you can go look at the Huffington Post if you want to see someone try to contradict them. Anyway, so that should be interesting. Also, Robert Stinnett. I said, because I was trying to think of what was his middle initial. I think I used to know it. I think it's B. I think it's Robert B. Stinnett, author of Day of Deceit, The Truth About FDR and Pearl Harbor, will be on the show again today. Pretty much I try to interview him every December 7th. Or if I can't, the 6th. Doesn't always work out, but pretty much I try every year to interview Robert Stinnett about his story. I think it's kind of important. So, we'll see about that. And then Michael Meharry's going to be here from the 10th Amendment Center. And these guys are the leading experts on nullification and interposition. And I don't just mean that they'll recommend that you go read the Kentucky Resolution. I'm saying they actually nullify and interpose in real life. That's their specialty, getting state governments to tell the national government no. And on the most important issues. And they really do a great job, and I think set a great example for, how politics can be done in America. Even Lysander Spooner said, it's not a sin to vote in self-defense, so it's okay to participate in the process to a degree, It just depends on how you look at it. I wouldn't participate in the process. This is me participating in the process. But if some people want to go join up a political party of one description or another, or form a group to pressure their state or federal officials on this, that, or the other thing, hell yeah, Especially if you're trying to stop them from doing something horrible, that's the most important thing. And that's what the 10th Amendment Center is about. That's what I really like about them, too. They could probably have more success if they would aim a lot lower. But their thing is, how do we get the states to interfere with the will of the National Security Agency? With the practice of the National Security Agency? How can we protect Americans from that? How can we get the states to declare their unwillingness to cooperate with military abduction and detention of any U.S. persons in their states? You see what I mean? They're good on stuff. So, I don't know Michael Meharry, but any friend of Michael Bolden's is a friend of mine, and we're going to be talking about mostly, I guess, the Utah thing, but whatever other successes. Does anybody read U.S. News and World Report? I used to know a guy once upon a time who had a subscription to U.S. News and World Report. It's sort of the bastard child of Newsweek and Time, but Newsweek, they don't even print that anymore. I guess U.S. News was the more Republican one, right? Anyway, they ran a great piece about the 10th Amendment Center and their efforts to nullify the NSA. So, that's the occasion for this interview. Speaking of things I should have reread this morning, you know, before the show, and I know it's not the morning, but feels like it to me still, okay? Let's see, U.S. News, NSA, nullification. I'm not that great of a typist, but, you know, I do all right. There we go. Some NSA opponents want to nullify surveillance with state law. You know, I do have that tab open somewhere, don't I? I did. Yeah, here it is. See, now I got it twice. What a great intro to the show, Scott. You spent 7 minutes telling us who's going to be on the show today. Think you could pare that down a little bit? All right, I'll try. Coming up, Steve Horn, Robert Stinnett, Michael Meharry on the Scott Horton Show today. All right, so now I guess what I'm supposed to talk about is Nelson Mandela died. And so everybody's saying what they think about Nelson Mandela. And in fact, I've been specifically, I've got a request. You know, like top 40. I've got a request that, hey, I want to hear the Scott Horton version of what's the real truth about this guy. Because I hear a lot of sainthood and not much criticism. And so what's up with that? Well. So I don't know. First of all, I'm not the world's expert on the guy's whole story and everything about him. And, you know, the last time South Africa was really the U.S. government's business in a way that was very important politically, I was still a kid in the 1980s. That was really, you know, before I was paying that much attention, it was already over kind of thing. And unlike the Cold War with the Soviet Union, it was a side issue. Part of the Cold War, in fact, but a side issue. So not something that I learned a whole lot about as a kid. I mean, I did know about it. The end apartheid movement, the boycotts and the sanctions and whatever. I did know about that when I was a kid, but only very generally speaking. And I knew it was very important, of course, at the time. But now, so this guy's whole story, I guess I'll try to say whatever bad I could say about him, which would be that he was not the perfect MLK, Gandhi, nonviolent peace activist, if you're a pacifist. He supported armed rebellion, and yet he had every right to. That's the whole thing about it. You know, if you're a pacifist, that's great, but pacifism never, I don't believe I've ever met a pacifist who implies that everyone else's duty is to sit there and take it, too. Just that they would prefer to sit there and take it than dish out violence themselves because they don't want to be a violent person and they're that committed to it and that is what it is and that's absolutely cool. But I don't know anybody, I've never heard of a pacifist who would mandate that no one else has the right to defend themselves either. And the fact of the matter is that the blacks of South Africa in the era of Nelson Mandela from, you know, whenever he began his career in activism, I guess it would have been in the 50s, they had the right to resist. They were living under totalitarian slavery, basically, as simple as that. They had no political rights whatsoever. They couldn't meet. They had no guarantee of a right to assemble or to associate freely with each other. All the different parts of black South Africa were cut, like the West Bank, into these Bantu stands. With, you know, whatever razor wire between them so that no faction could ever have that much power. Everybody's, you know, pitted against each other. It's like a giant slave plantation, you know? That's what apartheid was, the science of how to own and control the majority and treat them as absolute, you know, lowest helots with no real rights whatsoever. And so it's funny, you know, I was talking with a friend who explained to me that, you know, apartheid now, it just typically means, it's used to mean where it's minority rule over the majority and, you know, in a tyrannical fashion where they deny the majority rights and democratic voting rights and whatever other participation in power. But how back then it had a much more specific definition and it was basically like the science of how to do this and what all rights had been abolished. Like, for example, you had a lot of Indians and other Asians. I'm supposed to put mute on this thing so that when people text me during the show, it doesn't sound like I'm baking cookies. Sometimes I forget. Asians in South Africa, they had representation in Parliament. I mean, some. But the blacks had none. And anyway, so it was the CIA, as our old friend Jeff Stein reminds us. Where was it, in the Post this morning? It was the CIA that turned him in when he was on the run. And actually, from what I understand, and again, my information is pretty limited here, but from what I understand about the ANC's rebellion, at least while Mandela was running it, it was infrastructure attacks. They were blowing up objects and not people. And it was not, I mean, as far as, you know, spin in the West was concerned, they were Al-Qaeda, but not quite, you know. And I'm sure they did kill some innocent people, whatever. I don't know exactly what all happened. He was turned in by the CIA, I believe, in what, 61 or 64 or something, way back. So whatever happened after that wasn't him. And yeah, you know, people talk about necklacing with tires and that kind of thing. I'm sure there was all kinds of brutal crap that happened in the wars between the different factions as they were played against each other by the power, by the whites in power. And I'm sure that, you know, between the blacks and the whites, there were war crimes probably committed on all sides too in a violent resistance. But, you know, the story that everybody makes such a great deal about, I think, is, as far as I can tell, is absolutely justified. That here's a guy who, you know, I just read a thing by Adam Sewer, I think is his name, where he quoted from his sentencing hearing, where he says, listen, I don't want black power over the whites. I just want full participation in democracy. That's it. Which would mean black power necessarily, but he's saying he's not trying to strip the political rights away from the whites the way they had done to the blacks. All he wanted was one man, one vote, equal participation. That was what he said way back in 1960, whatever the hell. And when they finally let him out of prison in 1994, and he was, you know, almost instantaneously elected president, that's what he did. And they did. There was no revenge, massive killing, and whatever. And I mean, really, for all the fear that what was going to happen was that the black majority, if given the chance, would act the way the whites had acted against them, they had the right to. I mean, not necessarily indiscriminately, but you know, they were certainly the wronged in the equation. And what Nelson Mandela did was, in effect, for the whole society, let's all just have one big peace and reconciliation. No more hard feelings. No more fighting over the state power and using it to completely beat each other over the head with it. Now, let's raise up everybody's boat at once. And he really meant it. And he stuck with that. And now, it sounds funny, because I can hear it in my own ears. It sounds kind of funny, like, oh yeah, that's a good house slave who doesn't burn the master's house down when he's finally freed, but goes on about his way or whatever like that. But of course, it wasn't any interest of mine. And it would have been indiscriminate violence, right? If it had been a race war, and it would have been a bad thing. I think they would have had the right to go to war, maybe. But doesn't mean that it would be the best option. And what he chose to do was not burn down the master's house, but try to have equal participation. And there was accountability in the form of the commission, the Truth and Reconciliation Commission, where, you know, in order to not be prosecuted, you got to fess up the truth of what you did. You know, I don't know if it was perfect accountability or whatever, but if you think about what all could have come out of the situation of the end of apartheid, that was pretty great, you know? That it was like the end of the Soviet Union, you know? Almost completely nonviolent, just fell apart. And of course, there's a whole lot of you know, America's involvement here. Of course, the U.S. and Israel, apartheid America and apartheid Israel, were the last two countries in the world to still support apartheid South Africa at that point. And even after the Americans forsook them, the Israelis were still their partners to the bitter end, including trying to help them with their nuclear weapons technology that they had already developed themselves anyway. You know, in America, the whole theme was, hey, and this might sound familiar to Americans, too. Any black guy, you know, walking around with a sign that says, I am a man on it, what he really means is, it's a Bolshevik commie takeover of America, which is the most weak and pathetic birther-style ridiculous argument beneath contempt for its stupidity of a way for conservative whites to try to deny rights to blacks. That, you know what, here's 500,000 blacks, most of them devout Christians, right, marching. Oh, no, it's all a front for the three of them that are devout Marxist, atheist, godless commies loyal to the Soviet Union. Oh, all of civil rights is just a red herring for the commies. But, of course, the only sense in which that was true was the commies were trying to lash themselves on to black guys standing around with signs saying, I am a man on it, and saying, yeah, this is our fight. And if you resent that, then you only got to ask yourself, where were the conservatives? They sure weren't the ones marching with the blacks. You know, at least the commies talked a good game about equality. Now, of course, and again, well, not again, here's a distinction people got to make, too, between commie rebels who may believe crazy things but may also be perfectly in the right for what they're really fighting for, and the commie government in the USSR, in the Kremlin, in Moscow. I mean, that's the evil empire, okay? Or, you know, an evil empire. But commie rebels from here, there, to the other place, most of the time, are just picking up the only alternative they think they have to the fascist police states that they live in. And in most cases, most of us were decent people. If it's just Marxist guerrillas versus, you know, fascist colonels with mirrored sunglasses, and the Marxist guerrillas are, you know, the poor and the peasants who've been treated lawlessly and ruthlessly all along, we'd be on the side of the commie revolutionaries, right? I would be. Anyway, I might even have more to say about that here in a minute.
Hey, I'm Scott Horton here to talk to you about this great new book by Michael Swanson, The War State, The Cold War Origins of the Military-Industrial Complex and the Power Elite. In the book, Swanson explains what the revolution was, the rise of empire, and the permanent military economy, and all from a free market libertarian perspective. Jacob Hornberger, founder and president of the Future Freedom Foundation, says the book is absolutely awesome, and that Swanson's perspectives on the Cold War and the Cuban Missile Crisis are among the best I've read. The poll numbers state that people agree on one thing, it's that America is on the wrong track. In The War State, Swanson gets to the bottom of what's ailing our society. Empire. The permanent national security bureaucracy that runs it, and the mountain of debt that has enabled our descent down this dark road. The War State could well be the book that finally brings this reality to the level of mainstream consensus. America can be saved from its government and its arms dealers. First, get the facts. Get The War State by Michael Swanson, available at your local bookseller and at Amazon.com. Or just click on the book in the right margin at scotthorton.org.
Why does the U.S. support the tortured dictatorship in Egypt? Because that's what Israel wants. Why can't America make peace with Iran? Because that's not what Israel wants. And why do we veto every attempt to shut down illegal settlements on the West Bank? Because it's what Israel wants. Seeing a pattern here? Sick of it yet? It's time to put America first. Support the Council of the National Interest at councilforthenationalinterest.org and push back against the Israel lobby and their sock puppets in Washington, D.C. That's councilforthenationalinterest.org.
Hey, Al Scott here. Ever wanted to help support the show and own silver at the same time? Well, a friend of mine, libertarian activist Arlo Pignatti, has invented the alternative currency with the most promise of them all. QR Silver commodity discs. The first ever QR code 1-ounce silver pieces. Just scan the back of one with your phone and get the instant spot price. They're perfect for saving or spending at the market. And anyone who donates $100 or more to the Scott Horton Show at scotthorton.org/donate gets one. That's scotthorton.org/donate. And if you'd like to learn and order more, send them a message at commoditydiscs.com or check them out on Facebook at /commoditydiscs. And thanks.
Yeah, you know what's funny is the fact that the civil rights movement in America was not just a smokescreen for communism had been laid bare back in the 1960s. It was as simple as that. That whole, line of argument by the American right had fallen apart by then. I mean, basically they were Democrats, and Democrats are more or less pro what they now call capitalism, but you know what I mean. The status quo. Democrats, they're conservatives. They just wanted to pass some laws making it illegal to discriminate and illegal to keep people from being able to vote and a couple of crazy things like that. So, communists had latched on to the American Civil Rights Movement, but those who defined the Civil Rights Movement by that communist connection were proven to have just been fools. And, that was what the communists wanted the Civil Rights Movement to believe, and that's why the right ended up glomming onto their statements that they really were the ones who deserved the credit, but they weren't. And anyway, the same myth was still, perpetuated all the way through the end of the Cold War when it came to South Africa. Oh, yeah, no, apartheid, hey, it's necessary to keep the communists down. Don't you mean the black supermajority of the country? No, it's the communists that are the threat there. And, in fact, that sewer piece I was just reading, it's at MSNBC quotes William F. Buckley of the National Review comparing Mandela to Vladimir Lenin and saying, if this guy ever got out of jail and got the power, the implication then being that all whites would be massacred. That this guy was just a warlord in waiting, whatever. Then he came to power, Mandela, when he finally got out of prison, he came to power. He was no communist. And in fact, a friend of mine linked to this article by John Pilger, the famous leftist journalist who's complaining that by the time Mandela got out, he went and interviewed him and got in a fight with him about, man, you're such a sellout to white corporate power now. Because when he got out, he took power, but he did not lead a French Revolution to overturn the entire society. And I'm sure in many ways the changes fell short. Again, I'm not the world's expert on South America. sound like Sarah Palin now. I'm not the world's expert on South Africa by any means. And so I don't know really how much the quality of life and or the relative amount of political power has changed for the formerly powerless black majority there. I don't know. I assume things are a hell of a lot better than they were back during the totalitarian police state. And then here was one more thing that I appreciated about Mandela, for a guy who became the chief executive of anything ever, is that he voluntarily just stepped down after, I don't know if it was one or two terms, but he wanted to deliberately set the precedent that, man, we want to have a democratic system here rather than, and I'm a libertarian and democracy is not the end all to me. Liberty is the end all to me, but it's better than living in a fascist dictatorship. And he wanted to set the standard that George Washington set, either deliberately or not, I don't know, that it's the right thing to give up power and to set the example that, it's the system here that we want to preserve and the rights that that system protects rather than the power for whoever happens to have it at any given time. So, compare it to the change of power most often throughout history. I mean, I guess there's a lot of dying of natural causes too, but there's a hell of a lot of blood and war and revolution over power, and elections aren't the worst way to do it. Though you know me, I'm down for secession to the last man. Sometimes you can't just start out that way by snapping your fingers. And anyway, the only reason I even try to give such a balanced appraisal of a guy who's known as such a saint as Mandela, basically, is because everybody else is treating him like a saint. It seems important to point out that he was on the side of right, yeah, but the people who are all praising him now weren't, mostly, you know, or at least here in this country. So anyway, and I think it's, again, that Adam Sewer piece at NBC where he compares Mandela to Martin Luther King that way, too. Oh, yeah, everybody claims to love Martin Luther King now. And to claim to be against Martin Luther King in polite company anyway is to be against what he stood for, which was stop being such a jerk. You know, recognize other people as human, even if they look a little bit different than you. Is that so much to ask? And who could be against that? And of course, that's really true, right? Even if you see somebody who makes a really good case for why one might not like Martin Luther King, don't you figure that they just have a chip on their shoulder because they don't like black people? Otherwise, what do you care if he cheated on his wife or not or whatever, you know? Or if he copied and pasted his PhD. He was the guy that, well, the way I was raised, this is before my time, but the way I was raised to believe it was that I have a dream speech is what really made it, where a lot of white people said, you know, we kind of have been lording it over the minority here with our power and everything, and maybe we could stop being quite as evil as previously, y'all, maybe. It became, it was really the beginning of the end anyway of it being okay for people to be horrible bigots in polite company. That fell out of style. And mostly because of the clip that they always play. They never play the whole speech. The part they always play is live out your creed. That everybody's born with just as much rights and dignity as everybody else. Well, if that's the slogan of this whole thing, then what the hell? Only said it all nice-like. So, who cares whatever flaws he had? You know, people look past that to the greatness of him. But I guess I look at it like, you know, it is still worth bringing up, if only to convince the people who would focus on the bad, that like, no, man, actually, you know, even if Mandela led a guerrilla movement for a while and wasn't the paragon of virtue that he's painted on now, look at what he ended up doing with the power. You know, a lot better than a lot of people would have in the same situation. And in fact, I think it's David Weigel, or it could have been that Sewer piece again, where he says that Mandela was so kind and so not abusive with his power over his former white minority rulers that people mistakenly chalked it all up to him. Like he was the only thing keeping him at bay. And it's Weigel pointing out, there's a bunch of right-wing rumors that the race war is now finally about to begin. It's because they love being afraid of something always. Not because they're ever right. That's why we call them the right. Oh, man, I'm late. Sure hope I can make my flight.
Stand there.
Me? I am standing here.
Come here.
Okay.
Hands up. Turn around.
Whoa, easy.
Into the scanner.
Ooh, what's this in your pants?
Hey, slow down. It's just my...
Hold it right there. Your wallet has tripped the metal detector. What's this? The bill of rights?
That's right. It's just a harmless stainless steel business card-sized copy of the Bill of Rights from SecurityEdition.com. There for exposing the TSA as a bunch of liberty-destroying goons who've never protected anyone from anything. Sir, now give me back my wallet and get out of my way. Got a plane to catch.
Have a nice day.
Play a leading role in the security theater with the Bill of Rights Security Edition from SecurityEdition.com. It's the size of a business card, so it fits right in your wallet, and it's guaranteed to trip the metal detectors wherever the police state goes. That's SecurityEdition.com. And don't forget their great Fourth Amendment socks.
Hey, guys, I got his laptop.
Hey, y'all, Scott Horton here for WallStreetWindow.com. Mike Swanson is a successful former hedge fund manager whose site is unique on the web. Subscribers are allowed a window into Mike's very real main account and receive announcements and explanations for all his market moves. The Federal Reserve has been inflating the money supply to finance the bank bailouts and terror war overseas. So Mike's betting on commodities, mining stocks, European markets, and other hedges against our depreciating dollar. Play along on paper or with real money and then be your own judge of Mike's investment strategies. See what happens at WallStreetWindow.com.
Hey man, one more thing about apartheid in South Africa, y'all. I found out from a friend this morning that it wasn't always, even though it was white rule, it wasn't exactly apartheid in the exact most specific definition of it in like the 50s. It was in the late 50s when they really started instituting it in full effect, what we now call apartheid. And what the South Africans did was they took a field trip to Mississippi to see how it's done. And then that was when they came back and instituted their policy of which specific rights were banned for which people in what circumstances and how to divide the different groups from each other and whatever. Anyway, fun little bit of trivia there for you. All right. Now, our first guest on the show today is Steve Horn, this time writing for Counterpunch. Welcome back to the show, Steve. How are you doing?
Good. How are you?
I'm doing real good. Appreciate you joining us today. The piece here is globally renowned activist collaborated with Stratfor. What's a Stratfor?
So Stratfor is the short form of a firm or corporation based in Austin, Texas, called Strategic Forecasting Inc., which has actually been around for a few decades using other names that eventually became Stratfor. It was originally known as Pagan International. It morphed into a firm called Mongovan, Bisco, and Duchin, which ended up merging with the firm that's known as Stratfor in the late 90s in Austin, Texas. And the guy who founded, let's rewind back to the Mongovan, Bisco, and Duchin days. The guys who founded that firm, one of them was actually one of the original Army Delta Forces. Another person was a spokesman for the Republican National Committee, and then another guy was just a guy with a corporate PR background. That firm ended up merging with Stratfor in the late 90s, which was when that one founded. Actually, in 2002 is when the merger happened, but Stratfor was started in the late 90s, and the ideology of the two firms merged together, too. But George Friedman is the chairman of Stratfor right now, and he's a kind of an academic, geopolitical, I consider him kind of a warrior intellectual type who was an academic for a while at Dickinson College and ended up starting Stratfor. So that started in the late 90s, and it exists into today. It's basically a firm that maintains both the U.S. government and corporate clients and just gathers intelligence, not the type of intelligence the CIA would gather on the ground, but mostly open source stuff on behalf of its clients. And the reason why it's famous today is because of WikiLeaks. And
now, hold right there, because I just want to say one thing about them, which is my only experience with them that I can think of is Friedman used to do, it must be the same guy, I'm actually not positive, but I think this is the same guy we're talking about, that he was a regular guest on the morning show on 590 AM KLBJ here in Austin, Texas. And in 2002 and 2003, this is of course when there's 1000% unanimous opinion that we absolutely must go to Iraq. And the thing about Friedman was that he was conservative enough and he had a history with the boss, and the guy who hosted the morning news show was the boss of the station. And he had a history with this guy going back to before September 11th, where he knew that this guy is a genius about what all is going on in the world all the time. And so therefore, it was okay for him to oppose the Iraq war day in and day out as a regular guest on 590. And all I remember about it was him giving reasons like the Iranians are going to gain influence in Iraq and the South, and it's going to lead to an increase in anti-American terrorism, and all the reasons that anybody who was being critical then knew why not to do it. He was really good on all those things. And then it's Mark Caesar is the guy's name, the host of the show. All he could ever say was, well, you know, I guess that's interesting, and we'll just have to agree to disagree or whatever, and just go along with the rest of the talking points. But the point being that they would still let him on because of what a big shot he was. But that, and I guess it is important for someone who has influence and has something to lose, that he was, you know, very critical. I mean, not that he talked bad about Bush or any of the decision makers or whatever, but he vehemently disagreed with the policy, at least the way I remember it back then.
So you're saying Friedman disagreed, or you're saying that the host?
Yeah, okay. Friedman did. Yeah, the whole radio station and everything, they were all just going along with the conventional anything. But I'm saying that Friedman was sort of had license to disagree because of his previous reputation with these guys, you know?
Interesting. I mean, there's another article that was in the New York Times in 2003, just to go to that same era, and it was by Matt Bai, and this is sort of, I think maybe he had changed his position by then. I don't know. It seems like he was pretty favorable to the Iraq War at that time, but...
I could be mistaken. Like, you know,
potentially, but
I used to confuse Stratfor and global security, Pike and whatever. So I, you know, who knows? I don't know.
Still many, yeah. Well, I would just say that even if his position changed, it wouldn't be shocking. Although I'd be surprised if he wasn't kind of hawkish based on his academic background, that type of thing. But
yeah, I mean, he certainly seemed like a Republican type, but just. You know, anybody who really was looking at American national interest and not their own interest in that situation and, you know, had a couple of neurons to rub together knew better than that stupid war back then. So it's not like he was that unique in knowing better, just that he was unique that they let him know better on the radio.
Right. Yeah,
sort of
well,
like David Hackworth. So... Hackworth was also able to say, no, this is all wrong. And what are you going to do? He's Colonel Hackworth, so you have to let him say it, you know? But they ain't going to let Michael Moore on there or some, you know, liberal of any kind.
Right. Well, I mean, so say just the hypothetical that, if this was the same George Friedman and his position changed, it wouldn't be shocking because, I mean, what Stratfor does is, you know, they work for their clients, just like a PR firm would work for their clients, just like a law firm would, so... Maybe at some point his clients change, and I think the clients are important because they are some of the biggest corporations in the world, and they are often the U.S. government, various agencies that might do some stuff on behalf of the CIA and that type of thing here and there, depending on what the CIA needs. So, they're Stratfor has hired guns, and I think that gets to the story I wrote, which was about another guy who was... ended up being useful for Stratfor based on his own background, and that gets into the story of Serge Popovic, the Serbian very famous activist who was kind of the figurehead of the revolution in Serbia in the late 1990s.
All right, now, so... Well, so talk about that, because the actual revolution that brought down Milosevic was in 2000, right? So you're going back further.
Right. Yeah, so I'm going back, you know, Popovic at that time was a college student or right out of college and in Serbia, and he co-led an organization known as Otpor, which was an indigenous sort of social movement. It wasn't U.S.-sponsored when it started, but... towards the end, in the late 90s, 1999, 2000, a lot of U.S. funding started to kick, and a lot of people sort of excuse this funding and say it wasn't that much. They say it was minimal, but I mean, if you actually look at the numbers, it's a huge amount of money. They were given $10 million in 1999 and $31 million in 2000, towards the end of Milosevic's last days in Serbia, to do the type of work that they wanted to do. They have a good formula for just organizing, you know, just social movement type of stuff. What do you do to overthrow a leader? What do you do to, if you want to win a battle, what's your grand strategy? They're really good at that. And so they were inspired by Gene Sharp's writings, who's a really famous nonviolent political action theorist, and they were useful for U.S. geopolitical aims, which is, we know right before, you know, in 1998, the United States bombed Kosovo and was pretty brutal in that region along with NATO. So what I see as, at that time, Popovich and Otpor were useful to geopolitical purposes of the United States. But it's wrong to say they were pure puppets. It's just that at the end, a lot of money kicked in, which became useful and ended up getting rid of Milosevic and inserting a leader. Leaders got elected that were more friendly to U.S. Geopolitical interest in that particular region. And so that's sort of his background. Popovich ended up transitioning. He actually worked in the Serbian government for a while right after that, which is kind of telling to me. And then eventually ended up in 2004, so 4 years later, after the overthrow of Milosevic, ended up starting an organization called CANVAS, or the Center for Applied Nonviolence and Strategy. And this organization also ended up receiving a lot of U.S. funding from the National Endowment for Democracy and from USAID and from related interests, related foundation interests. And I ended up using the template of what they did in Serbia in other countries that were targeted. The United States wanted to do regime change. So, for example, in Ukraine in 2004, the guys who are not poor, who are now part of CANVAS, were training the activists in Kiev. So it's a good example, and that ended up overthrowing Yushchenko and overthrowing who was there and inserting Yushchenko. And so that's what happened then, and that wasn't a very popular government. In 2010, it was unseated.
That was NED, USAID, CIA money or not, or do you know?
Yeah. Definitely NED, definitely USAID, unclear CIA, but I think it's important to point out NED was essentially, it was created to do the work, type of work that the CIA was doing before.
Right. This is like Iran 53, only softer, right? It's not quite.
Right, exactly. So this is an illustration of soft power, and it's not that these movements are necessarily complete creations of the United States. They may have been geared to go in a different direction, and then that U.S. funding or that the Western funding pushes it in a direction that they want. So that's the key. So it's not just that they're puppets, but mm-hmm. So Popovich, that's sort of the direction that his career went, and it's sort of a trainer of not just movements that were useful to the U.S. government, but often movements that were useful to the U.S. government, regime change that was useful to the U.S. government, which, as my story pointed out, I think made him, he's sort of a mercenary type of figure where he'd work with anyone. It's not that lucrative of a career to be an activist trainer, so he would take money from almost anyone. And I think that was the lore of him to end up becoming a source for a firm like Stratfor, which he started to become. It's unclear exactly when he got in touch with them originally, but I think it was in about 2007 or 2008, and then for the next few years, he was in touch quite a bit as a source for their Eurasia, Eastern Europe intelligence guy. His name is Marko Papich, and he's no longer there, but they were the WikiLeaks emails show that he had a quite close relationship with Stratfor, and ended up, just to talk about one of the more fascinating parts, he ended up getting his wife a job there too, and that shows up in those WikiLeaks emails too. And his wife was a weekend open source intelligence analyst, where she just read a lot of news and compiled it in a way that was useful to Stratfor, and was worked there for about a year. So it wasn't as if he was very close to Stratfor. Ended up inviting many of the people on the Stratfor staff even to his wedding. So it was, He was definitely close with Stratfor in a quite intimate way.
Well, now, so this just means that he's traveling around the world emailing them about what's going on, or what was he doing for them?
Yeah, and so that's the really interesting part. So because of his job, his other job that he still has as an employee of the group that he started, CANVAS, he maintains a lot of relationships with activists around the world, including the activists in Egypt, Tahrir Square, including activists in Venezuela who didn't like Hugo Chavez, including almost anywhere around the world. Our article points out CANVAS has trained activists in 50 countries, and it's those relationships that were key. They're the relationships that Stratfor wanted to exploit for their own clients, which is a good way to gather intelligence on the ground activist development and see, you know, what kind of things are happening that might not be in the interest of our corporate clients, for example. Well, this guy opens a whole new door and window that they never had before because he does have a lot of street cred as a revolutionary activist, as an activist trainer. So those relationships were the basis of him getting there. And what he was doing often was forwarding off emails, for example, to stretch
for. Are these like general intelligence assessments? Here's everything that I can figure out is going on in Bahrain that you need to know, or here's everything you needed to know about those people that you sent me here to rat on, you know?
Yeah, it's mostly the former. It's mostly general intelligence assessments, but also a little more specific than that. So he would sometimes give his own assessment, but sometimes he would actually forward emails from activists where they were talking about what was going on to him, sort of as the guy that they trust to talk about activist strategy. He would take those emails, and then which are a little more intimate and might talk a little bit more about strategy, mm-hmm. and he would forward those to Stratfor. So sometimes he would do the general assessments, but there are many times where you can see in the emails where he was just forwarding things off, and you know, he ended up doing that one time. I think the most illustrative one happened in Egypt, where an email was forwarded, and he almost kind of mocked that activist and mentioned, quote-unquote, exploiting the relationship to a person at Stratfor that he forwarded the email off to. So it was some pretty sick stuff.
I'm glad you mentioned the Egypt one. I wanted to follow up on that because so there was a piece criticizing your initial piece here at Counterpunch, Steve, by the Yes Men at the Huffington Post, and then you mm-hmm. wrote a thing defending your piece from theirs, and people can go and follow up on all of that themselves, and you can talk about that if you want. But the part I wanted to focus on there was what you said about Egypt, because I'm sorry I don't have the exact part of the response in front of me, where it makes very clear, I think. Well, no, maybe not. It sounds to me like what's going on here is Stratfor is a middleman between this guy and the American government, and they're you know, basically helping run him, and that their interest is in helping Omar Suleiman, who we already know that because they blurted it out all over the front page of the New York Times, actually, that their plan was, well, geez, we want to hang on to Mubarak no matter what. This is, you know, January 2011, January, February. We want to hang on to Mubarak no matter what, but if we can't keep him, we want to keep Omar Suleiman, the head of the secret torture police. He's our number two uh-huh. runner-up to be the next pharaoh of Egypt. That's what they wanted. And
exactly.
This thing is, this is doesn't sound to me like he's on the side of the April 6th movement revolutionaries, who I would think that he's helping run them, and this is some kind of regime change, color-coded regime change against Mubarak. This is, apparently, he's on the side of those attempting to contain that Arab Spring revolution that was going on in Cairo at that point, even talking about, well, explain about Tahrir Square and the rest of this.
Sure, yeah. So I mean, I think this is an illustrated example where he forwards an email from the activist, and then it takes a while for the Stratfor employee to email back, and he ends up apologizing what he was late, because they were, as a firm, they were talking about what the hell to do about Egypt, because it was such a tumultuous time in Egypt, and I assume they had a lot of clients, business clients in the region. They're trying to figure out, what do we do about this eruption in the streets in Tahrir Square? And so they end up talking about, okay, so yes, the Stratfor employee asks Popovich, you know, how long are they going to be in Tahrir, first of all? How long is it possible they're going to be here for so much longer? When are they going to tire out? And then second of all, they talk about sort of their preference, and their preference was the same preference as the U.S. government, which was try to contain it to, if Mubarak is going to go, we'd prefer to see Suleiman in it. That's paraphrasing it, but that's what you can see in the email. And so they, obviously, there was an alignment between U.S. business interests and Stratfor's clients and the U.S. government itself at that time. And, you know, Egyptian activists on the ground weren't okay at all with having Suleiman being inserted as the next dictator of Egypt, so definitely wasn't in line with the demands of the people on the ground in Tahrir Square. And that's a good example, though, of what Popovich's use was, and that's use activist context to get a lens into what's going on the ground, and then ask, and then they would ask him, sort of, what can you do to help us steer it in the direction that we're looking for? And so both of them benefited, because I assume that he wasn't doing all this. I mean, I can't say for sure. We didn't claim it, but I assume that he must have gotten some kind of financial compensation for this, or at least thought it would be a career ladder for him to climb, gaining contacts at a firm like Stratfor, that kind of thing. So he was benefiting from it in some way. But Stratfor was benefiting from it, obviously, with the contacts that he was providing them and a glimpse inside of social movements that they never would have had if it wasn't for a guy like him. Because, I mean, the alternative is sending undercovers into social movements, undercover police agents, that type of thing. But those people can be more easily outed. They don't have, especially if they're not known, and it often happens where undercovers are outed. Whereas this guy had so much cred from his time in Serbia and then beyond that it was easy for him to keep in touch with these activists. They actually sought him out for his advice. That's how easy it was for him to be a source for them being Stratfor.
And now, what can you tell us about what he was doing down in Venezuela?
Yeah, so Venezuela is another interesting case study. Obviously, the U.S. government hated Hugo Chavez. Now he's passed away. But in 2007, like I said, activists sought out Hugo Chavez. And Hugo Chavez wasn't liked by everyone in Venezuela. He wasn't liked by the U.S. government. There were some activists who did want to see him go. And so they sought out Canvas, actually, and Popovich. They ended up going in 2007 to Serbia for Belgrade, Serbia, for a training that was written about in their state media, B92 in Serbia, and which is actually funded by the U.S. government. And the article kind of explains that they were just getting the basic training that everyone else gets, sort of learning the template of what you need to do to overthrow a government you don't like. And I mean the actual theory is really interesting stuff, and I think a lot of activists could learn a lot from it. But the point is that he was acting kind of in service at that time to Hugo Chavez, who obviously wasn't liked at all by the Bush administration. And years later, he ended up writing, and I don't know who funded this, but I'd be interested to find out. He ended up writing a blueprint of sorts of how to, wasn't really how to overthrow Chavez, but how to unseat him, or just sort of his thinking on what's going on in Venezuela. And that's actually published now on the Canvas website, and it was published in 2010. So that can be, but he ended up sent, the interesting thing is he sent an advanced copy, the WikiLeaks email show. He sent an advanced copy of it to be looked at and examined by Stratfor. So that shows kind of how close he was with Stratfor and kind of who he was serving by doing things like this, which is both Stratfor and the U.S. government. And he ended up, obviously, I mean, the important thing to remember is that his group Canvas got money from the U.S. government for a long time. I don't know if it still does, but it definitely was quite a bit at that time.
Yeah. Hey, by the way, did this guy have any role to play in Tajikistan in, what, 05 or 06 there with the Tulip
Yeah, the Tulip Revolution, yeah. Or, yeah, Kyrgyzstan. I am pretty sure that he at least has contacts there, may have done some trainings. I haven't looked into it very closely, but that's, like I said, there's 50 countries that he claims that he's been in touch with activists with and done trainings with, so I wouldn't be completely shocked. And the emails did show that he had ongoing discussions, at least the Stratfor emails, he was having lots of discussions with at that time, the late 2000s, with later than the one you're talking about, but with activists in Eastern Europe and even in Central Asia, I saw, I think Azerbaijan maybe. So definitely very possible he was at least in touch with those activists, but I'm not sure if they end up doing trainings or not. Mm-hmm.
And then, I'm sorry, we only have a couple of minutes, but did you want to sum up what was the criticism? Did they have a point at all, or at least tell us where people can read about this controversy about the story here.
Yeah, you mentioned the Yes Men article, Yellow Journalism, and kind of sensationalistic and almost conspiratorial in a way. That's the crux of their criticism, but they never really made any very specific points other than to belittle what we found. They kind of would call our findings innocuous. They kind of mocked Stratfor as being kind of a stupid, non-sophisticated firm, that type of thing. So their main device was belittling it, not really actually grappling with the facts or critiquing the facts. And so what we did is just ended up writing a pretty long response to them to say that it's kind of inexcusable to be making excuses for someone who was collaborating with a firm like Stratfor, given what they've done in the past, given how sophisticated their formula is for undermining the wants and desires of activists. And then, essentially that's the crux of what we did. We haven't heard back from them since, but their article wasn't extremely popular, didn't gain much traction. I just think that Stratfor is a really important firm and has a really important and rich history that they ended up not really wanting to talk about too much. And I think it came down to the fact that they were actually friends with Popovich. Popovich had helped them a little bit with some trainings as a group, so they were kind of running PR for a friend, but I don't think it was a very serious look at who Stratfor is or what he did at Stratfor.
I think it's kind of ironic that it's the outsourcing of intelligence to this firm and then to this guy that's the scandal, rather than that he's employing all this great nonviolent revolution stuff in the service of the U.S. empire, which is the actual power on Earth that is in question here, right?
I would say that it's both. Often the U.S. funding that's is coming from the National Endowment for Democracy, or USAID, or the State Department, and that funding's in service to the U.S. empire. But that's not hard power. That's soft power funding. But both are, I think, equally important in terms of the final aims of what the empire wants. So, that's why I think ultimately he was a natural choice for Stratfor, was because often, not always, but often the U.S. empire's trajectory or what it wants, what it seeks, is in line with U.S. business interests. Not always, but I think that would be why he was kind of a natural career choice for him.
Yeah. All right. Well, listen, we're all out of time, but thanks very much for your time. Good work here.
Yeah, thanks for having me.
Appreciate it. All right, everybody, that's Steve Horn. He's a journalist out of Wisconsin, and he's got these pieces you need to look at Counterpunch, globally renowned activist collaborated with Stratfor, and how defending private intelligence firm collaborators screws grassroots activists. We'll be right back with Robert Stinnett after this. Hey, I'm Scott Horton here for The Future Freedom, the monthly journal of the Future Freedom Foundation. As you may already be aware, Jacob Hornberger, Sheldon Richman, and James Bovard are awesome. They're also in every issue of The Future Freedom, and they're joined by others of the best of the libertarian movement. People like Anthony Gregory, Wendy McElroy, Lawrence Vance, Joe Stromberg, and many more. Even me. Sign up for The Future Freedom at fff.org/subscribe. It's just $25 a year for the print edition, $15 to read it online. That's The Future Freedom, edited by Sheldon Richman at fff.org/subscribe. And tell you heard it here. Hey, y'all, Scott here, hawking stickers for the back of your truck. They've got some great ones at libertystickers.com. Get your son killed, Jeb Bush 2016, FDR, no longer the worst president in American history, the National Security Agency, blackmailing your congressman since 1952, and USA. Sometimes we back Al-Qaeda, sometimes we don't. And there's over 1,000 other great ones on the wars, police state, elections, the Federal Reserve, and more at libertystickers.com. They'll take care of all your custom printing for your band or your business at thebumpersticker.com. libertystickers.com. Everyone else's stickers suck. Hey, y'all, Scott here. Man, I had a chance to have an essay published in the book Why Peace, edited by Mark Gutman, but I didn't understand what an opportunity it was. Boy, do I regret I didn't take it. This compendium of thoughts by the greatest anti-war writers and activists of our generation will be remembered and studied long into the future. You've got to get Why Peace. You've got to read Why Peace. It features articles by Harry Brown, Robert Naiman, Fred Bronfman, Dahlia Wasfi, Richard Cummings, Karen Katowski, Butler Schaefer, Kathy Kelly, Robert Higgs, Anthony Gregory, and so many more. Why peace? Because war is the health of everything wrong with our society. Get Why Peace. Down at the bookshop or Amazon.com. Just click the book in the right margin at scotthorton.org. All right, y'all. Welcome back to the show. It's the show. I'm Scott Horton. This is my show, Scott Horton Show. The website is scotthorton.org. New and improved, brand new. Check out the new front page at scotthorton.org. Pulling together all the latest from all the different parts of the site, kind of a thing. And sure seems like an improvement to me, so stop by, check it out. scotthorton.org. All right, now our next guest on the show today is Robert Stinnett, American historian and World War II Navy vet, author of Day of Deceit, The Truth About FDR and Pearl Harbor. Welcome back to the show, Robert. How are you doing?
Thank you for inviting.
Well, I'm very happy to have you back on the show. Please tell us, sir, if you could, about your service in the U.S. Navy during World War II.
Yes, sir. In World War II, I was assigned, I volunteered for the Navy, and I was assigned to aircraft carrier USS San Jacinto in the Pacific. It was part of the offensive task force in fighting the Japanese. So we spent the entire time there, and one of our pilots that flew with was a young ensign by the name of George Bush, later became president of the United States. So it was quite a fate to be assigned. Of course, we had no idea that was going to happen.
Right. All right. Now, I'm sorry. We're still having that problem with your phone. You do have a good, loud, distinctive voice, sir. So I think if you could hold the handset away from your mouth a little bit and just talk at your normal voice, I hope that will help. I think it's actually your breath on the... You have a blown microphone on your phone. But I'm hoping that... It only sounds bad when you get nice and loud. So I'm thinking if you hold it a little bit away, then hopefully we'll still be able to proceed with you.
Is this any better?
Yeah, that sounds great. That sounds great. Luckily for us, you have a good distinctive voice. We can hear you just fine, even away from the phone. So I'm sorry to interrupt, sir, but it's best if we can continue in a way that's that people can hear.
Oh, yes, I want them to hear.
Right. Okay, so again, it's Robert Stinnett. It's Day of Deceit, The Truth About FDR and Pearl Harbor. And now this is, I think, always a great point to really get into. What happened there is how you found out, or really how you decided that you wanted to know this story and ultimately write this book about the truth on the question of what FDR knew before the Pearl Harbor attack. Can you talk about that?
Yes, like all Americans, and in fact, the people of the world, I believe the fact that the Japanese attack was a sneak attack on Pearl Harbor, and that it was planned to, without to sneak up on the Pacific Fleet, which was anchored at Pearl Harbor, and believe that until I read a book called "At Dawn We Slept" in 1982, and it mentioned in that book that the U.S. Navy had an intercepting station or a monitor station that they were listening to the Japanese fleet, and all of the messages, these are radio messages issued by Radio Tokyo to the carrier fleet that attacked us at Pearl Harbor. So I worked for the Oakland Tribune and suggested that for a story for the anniversary on December 7th, 1982. The editor agreed. And that's where I first learned and confirmed that we had a station manned by cryptographers that had broken the Japanese code and were listening and knew that the attack was coming.
All right. Now, from the very beginning, after the Pearl Harbor attack, people like John T. Flynn accused FDR of knowing about the attack and deliberately, more or less, turning a blind eye and allowing it to happen. And in your book, you actually put quite a bit into making the argument that not only was the code broken, but it had come to the attention of the necessary people, and that, in fact, the intelligence was being forwarded to the highest levels in Washington, D.C. Is that correct?
You know, that is correct, Scott. President Roosevelt in October 1940, this is 14 months before Pearl Harbor, and he adopted a Navy plan to entice Japan into attacking the fleet at Pearl Harbor. So he moved the fleet from the West Coast to Pearl Harbor in the spring of 1940. This angered the admiral in charge, and he protested and then had a meeting with the president in the Oval Office in October 1940, where the admiral got into a heated argument with the president and said that the Navy officers don't want to do this and don't have any confidence in your administration. Well, you don't talk to President Roosevelt that way. And the admiral was fired. But the president adopted the Overt Act of War plan, which was planned by the Navy on October 8th, 1940.
That's the Arthur McCollum memo of how to provoke Japan into attacking us first.
Exactly.
Mm-hmm. But now, on the specific question of the broken military code, they've sort of said all along that, as you say, it wasn't until the early 1980s that it came to your attention that there was any information out there that they had actually broken any military codes at all. Only the diplomatic codes had been the official story up until that time. But how can you be certain that the codes that were being broken, that intelligence that was coming from those military codes wasn't just being thrown in the waste paper basket? Because that would be the argument of the court historians here, would be that, Robert Stinnett imagines perfect information, but just because they had broken the code doesn't mean anyone was paying attention to it, doesn't mean that FDR or anyone in the cabinet would have known about it. Can you refute that?
You're right. That is, you had to overcome that allegation. But the National Archives in Washington, D.C., have the Navy records. These were top secret records that were not released until I filed a Freedom of Information Act. It's a whole series of FOIAs to get these records. They're called the Crane Files, because they were hidden in Navy vaults in Crane, Indiana. And these show that we had broken the Japanese Navy code, which was called Code Book D. That's what the Japanese called it, Code Book D. We called it RIP 80, Radio Intelligence Publication 80, or RIP 80. And these records are Navy records that were hidden and weren't available until I got these in 1995.
And then, now about that McCollum memo, we've talked before about how McCollum was a Navy intelligence officer and how, clearly this memo had gone up the chain of command. But you argued in the past, I believe, sir, that it was basically definitive, beyond question, that FDR himself was deliberately implementing this plan step by step, in order even, in the different provocations that were used from their point of view, to make sure that the Japanese would feel that they had no choice but to strike first.
That is correct, and that was difficult for me to believe, because during my tour of duty in the Navy, there was never any hint that this was taking place. And these eight provocations were suggested by Commander McCollum to the president in the Oval Office on October 8th, 1940, as I said earlier. And the admiral of the fleet was there arguing with the president, and he said, he called it a cockeyed plan. And this is all your readers, your listeners can see it in the National Archives. These are not my records. These are the National Archives.
I want to make sure I understand right. The argument where Admiral Richardson was fired because he objected to keeping the fleet at Pearl Harbor, that argument was actually not just about keeping the fleet at Pearl Harbor. It was about the implementation of the entire McCollum memo. That was what got Richardson fired, you're saying.
Yes, that is right. And Admiral Richardson tells about that in his book. It's called On the Treadmill to Pearl Harbor. And your listeners, they're interested, should get that book because he describes what went on in the meeting. And he also he met later that night after they had this knockdown drag-out with the president and with Navy officials in Washington and told them about it. And he said it was a cockeyed plan.
And now, I believe, sir, that when we first spoke, I first read your book back, it was either 2003 or 2004, and we spoke at that time. And then, but we've spoken quite a few times over the years since then, almost 10 years now. I feel very privileged for you giving me your time like this. But I believe that you actually changed your mind about one thing. At some point, you used to have it that Kimmel, Admiral Kimmel and General Short both had been cut out of the chain of information here. But later on, you decided that that wasn't true, that in fact, at least one or both of them had known about this, the impending attack, and they had turned their blind eye there on the scene, as blamed.
Well, that is correct, Scott. But President Roosevelt changed the secrecy orders on November 27th when he sent a message to the Pacific commanders, military commanders. One was in Manila. That was General MacArthur and Admiral Hart. And then Hawaii, it was Kimmel and General Short. And he told them that to stand aside and let Japan commit the first overt act of war. And that's what I call the McCollum memo was the overt act of war, which the president adopted in 1940. And because he issued that order on November 27th, resulted from our radio direction finders locating the Japanese fleet in the North Pacific, where they were breaking radio silence. Most authors say they did not break radio silence, that their radio transmitters were turned off and not able to use. But the records show that they were intercepted in the North Pacific. Hello?
Oh, I'm so sorry. J. Edgar Hoover and the FBI had a spy there in, or had officers there who had noticed a Japanese spy there in Pearl Harbor, correct?
Yes, that's right. There was a lone Japanese naval spy attached to the Japanese consulate in Honolulu, and he was spying on the Pacific Fleet. And in October, he prepared a bomb plot messages and sent to Tokyo over RCA communications, and we were also intercepting these. These were in addition to that code book D, and he assigned positions in the various anchorages in Pearl Harbor where the battleships were, where cruisers and destroyers. And President Roosevelt found out about that and knew about that and did sort of try to get Admiral Kimmel and General Short to do something about that. But then that all was changed on November 27th when President Roosevelt told them to stand aside and let Japan commit the first overt act of war.
Well, so, but what about Hoover? Why didn't Hoover have the FBI just nab the guy as soon as they found him?
Well, Edgar Hoover and agents were, his agents were following where the spy was going in the Hawaiian Islands. But Hoover was also under the control of President Roosevelt, and he followed the orders that let Japan commit the first overt act.
Right. That's also, that exact language is echoed in the Secretary of War's diaries as well, too, that we had to maneuver them into firing first.
Yes, that's right. In Secretary of War, it was Henry Stimson, and in his diary he was talking about, on November 25th, he was talking with the President to figure out ways to maneuver Japan into position to attack us at Pearl Harbor.
It's amazing. All right, now, and one thing is, too, that I think is very interesting to note here, I guess I should have mentioned this at the beginning, that you don't consider yourself any kind of cranky old right-wing Roosevelt hater by any means, correct? You're still very proud of your service in the war, and even you've told me in the past that you think that Roosevelt did what he had to do in order to get the Americans to stop the Germans.
Well, that is true. I believe, Scott, that they were just Roosevelt had two options. One was to not interfere with the Japanese attack and let Japan commit the first overt act, or not to do. Or to try to send the Pacific Fleet to interfere with the Japanese attack. And the Japanese had a far superior force, and they would have just sunk the entire fleet. The whole idea was to overcome the isolation movement in this country, where 80% of Americans wanted nothing to do with Europe's war. And that was the whole heart of this. And that's where McCollum came up with this memo to overcome the opposition, because he felt that if Americans could be convinced that it was a sneak attack, they would wholeheartedly support the war effort and then go after Germany, which was the real villain in this in World War II, because they had the ability, production availability. For building armaments and so forth.
Mm-hmm. I think that's an important point, because the conventional wisdom would have it that anyone who's as critical as you are about the facts of the lead-up to the attack must just have a bent against Roosevelt and against the war. And I think it's, you know, very important that people understand that that's actually not the point of view that you're coming from. As to them, to a lot of people, that would tend to discredit it, or in some way, if they're looking for a reason to not believe, that might be one. But to get back to the story here, what about I'm curious about when Roosevelt refused to meet with the Prime Minister of Japan, who had asked for direct talks in August of 1941. Wasn't that kind of scandalous? Weren't people saying, geez, here they're trying a last-ditch effort to avoid war, and our president won't even meet with them? Or how did that work out back in the late summer of 1941?
You're right. The Prime Minister, Kinoye was trying to arrange a meeting with the president to work out the plan. Well, he wanted nothing to do with that. He wanted the attack to take place to overcome this isolation movement and unite the American people. And that's what he wanted to do. So he did everything he could to avoid it. There were two Japanese emissaries that were sent here to try to work things out. But that was just a play contentions that they were involved in. Mm-hmm. The whole idea was to get Japan to make this attack and unite the country, which happened.
Right. But, I read about how his failure to get the talks, to get the audience with Roosevelt, led to his fall and his replacement by Tojo, which was, of course, a major step toward the start of the war there that fall. But what I'm curious about is that anti-war movement that you refer to and all the president's enemies, were they aware that he had refused to meet with the Japanese prime minister that August? And, I mean, that must have been huge ammo for their argument that he was deliberately trying to get the American people into a war that he'd promised not to get them into.
Oh, you were right. You know, the president was engaged in also in a third term run for president in the November election in 1940. Mm, so he promised American parents that your boys are not going to be sent into any foreign war. But what he didn't say was that unless we are attacked. So he put out this frontage that in his political speeches in the fall of 1940, that there would be no troops sent into the what was called Europe's war at the time.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and you know, it's interesting what you said about at that point where, you know, the week of the attack or what have you, that at that point the choice was to either have our Navy meet them out at sea and surely lose, or go ahead and take it on the chin. I mean, that was the position that they had put themselves in. I was raised to believe, I guess this is the History Channel version, is what great luck it was that none of the newer ships were in harbor that day, only the leftover World War I era ships, and that the carriers were out at sea and were spared from the attack. But I actually saw where I had written about you before on antiwar.com, and there's a very interesting comment there from a Japanese man saying that was Roosevelt's only choice at that point. Otherwise, if he had met us out at sea, we'd have sunk y'all's whole fleet, and we would have known that you'd broken the code. And then you would have had a much harder time for the rest of the war. And I guess at that point, he's attributing America's breaking of the military code a lot of credit. You know, he's giving that, a fact, a lot of credit for later naval successes against the Japanese fleet. Do you agree with that?
Oh, that's absolutely right. That's exactly what happened. The president was reading the Japanese Navy's messages, so he knew where the ships were, that they were in the North Pacific. This was before Pearl Harbor. And then after the nation was united to go against the Japanese and also Hitler, we learned that they were going to attack Midway. So we were able to ambush the Japanese fleet, which could have been done on December 7th. But President Roosevelt did not want that. He wanted America to be united by this sneak attack.
Right. Well, that's such an amazing story. And you have to admit, it's ironic, even if you favor it. And after all, the Imperial Japanese and the German Nazis were a couple of the worst regimes that have ever existed in the history of humanity. So there's not much arguing that point. But even if you're for this setup by the president, you got to admit it's kind of ironic that he's got to commit this worst act of treason ever in order to get the people to do the right thing and go fight the Nazis, right?
Well, that's right. But it goes back to the time of Plato and before Christ. Plato writes about it in his discourse called The Republic, where you get your enemies or other tribes to attack you, and then you can unite your own forces to go against other tribes. So it's one of the oldest ruses in military history.
Oh, I didn't realize that's in The Republic. I've read that. Why didn't I notice that?
Well, I'll have to go back now and look.
There's a whole book published by Harvard University about that. Let's see, her name is Cecilia Bok, B-O-K. She was the wife of the president of Harvard. Huh. It's a great book to read.
Isn't that interesting? Plato and the provocation. That's what the Russians call it, a provocation.
Yes, that's right.
Very interesting. All right, now... Can I ask you real quick? It's a kind of a minor point, but there was a historian, you may not remember, it's been a few years now, but there was a historian that wrote into antiwar.com saying, no, it's all about JN-25 and this and that factoid about JN-25. And you dismissed that completely, the way I recall, and said, no, again, as you mentioned earlier in the interview, it's all about Code Book D, Table 7. But can you explain the discrepancy there, why it is that this historian would cling to this JN-25 when, as you say, that's old information?
Well, the U.S. Navy designated, put this phony... a designator called JN-25 for the Japanese code book D, and it was to hide the fact that we had broken it in 1941, and they claimed that we'd broken JN-25. It wasn't until after the war, after the Pearl Harbor attack, but we had broken it prior to that. But they just put this phony name, JN-25.
I got it. It's the old cover story.
Most people believe that. Most historians. Well, there was nothing at the time to show that it was not true.
Right. All right. That's Robert Stinnett, author of Day of Deceit. Thank you so much for your time, sir. Appreciate it.
Bye.
Hey, Al Scott here for MyHeroesThink.com. They sell beautiful 7-inch busts of libertarian heroes, Ludwig von Mises, Murray Rothbard, Ron Paul, and Harry Brown. I've got the Harry Brown one on the bookshelf now. Makes me smile every time it catches my eye. These finely crafted statues from MyHeroesThink.com make excellent decorations for your desktop at work, bookends for your shelves, or gifts for that special individualist in your life. They're also all available in colors now, too. Of course, gold, silver, or bronze. Coming soon, Hayek, Hazlitt, Carlin. Use promo code Scott Horton and save $5 at myheroesthink.com.
Fact. The new NSA data center in Utah requires 1.7 million gallons of water every single day to operate. Billions of Fourth Amendment violations need massive computers and the water to cool them. That water is being supplied by the state of Utah. Fact. There's absolutely nothing in the Constitution which requires your state to help the feds violate your rights. Our message to Utah? Turn it off. No water equals no NSA data center. Visit offnow.org.
All right, y'all. Welcome back to the show. I'm Scott Horton. This is my show, The Scott Horton Show. ScottHorton.org for the new and improved website. It ain't finished yet, but it's getting better all the time. Check out the new front page there, ScottHorton.org. All right, so our next guest on the show is Michael Meharry from the 10th Amendment Center and TurnItOff.org. Welcome to the show, Michael. How are you doing?
I'm doing outstanding. Nice bump music.
Oh, you like that. Good. Yeah, it's difficult fingers. It's been out of rotation for a while. I put it back in.
Yeah, it's nice. So, it's nice to hear a little edgy music on the radio.
Yeah, there you go. All right, so hey, answer me this. Why would you extremists from the 10th Amendment Center have a problem with a National Security Agency program called FASCIA?
I've got a problem with pretty much everything that the NSA does.
Can you believe they named it that? What the hell is this? They could have named it, this is fascist Italy now, or just made it, you know, more
obvious.
In
one hand, you want to be surprised, and then on the other hand, it's like, yeah, that's about right. I mean,
just name it fascia. It'll be fine. I wonder if they had a little snicker about it at the office water cooler or what, you know?
Probably did. It's amazing. It seems like every single day something else comes out about what this entity is doing. And, I mean, it's almost kind of scary that all of this information keeps coming out because they think it's going to make people numb after a while. It's like, oh, yeah, it's an NSA, you know, doing this or that again. And when you really stop and think about it, it's absolutely disgusting that they are spying on virtually everybody in the entire world. Who does that? Well, you know, the federal government does that. So I think it's time to stop it.
Well, the thing of it, too, is, I guess the part of my brain that's seen TV a lot before or whatever comes up with these arguments about, well, you know, got to keep the dangerous world at bay and all of that. And after all, the NSA is as intrusive as they might be, even if they got a little drug that a drone that looks like a mosquito on your windowsill, they don't really have any police power over you, really. You know, they just, the worst they could do is, I guess, if you were an agent of a foreign power, turn it over to the FBI or something like that. But really, they're just accidentally surveilling all of us as they surveil everyone else. And yet, they already kind of debunked that because they showed that the NSA is turning over whatever they feel like about any crimes that they discover to federal, state, and local police. And then, with the instructions that you're to lie about how you found out about this, just go ahead and pull the guy over and pretend it's a coincidence that his trunk is full of drugs that day or whatever it is.
Exactly. Yeah. And you know, that just goes to the whole, what does this have to do with the war on terror? Not that the war on terror is legitimate in any sense. I mean, that's a whole different issue. But you know, supposedly the mission, if we believe all the BS, the mission is that they're going to protect us from the terrorists. What does some guy with a little weed in his car have to do with terrorists? It's appalling. But you're right. And essentially, the NSA is just one branch of the warfare state. And it's a branch that hands out information and allows the warfare state to take action, whether it be your local police or your state police or, you know, the CIA or, you know, some Marine Corps division or whatever it is. So it's definitely all part of a bigger picture.
I mean, if you think about it, from what we know of it so far from these Snowden leaks anyway, it seems like it must be kind of a limited operation. We got the NSA vacuuming up everything. They're not sharing all of it. I don't know how they pick and choose what they give to the DEA or to the Texas Rangers or whatever they do, but just think of it if they decided to flip the switch or, you know, in other words, have Dianne Feinstein pass an edict saying that, oh, yeah, by the way, local sheriff's departments, come and scoop up whatever you want about all the people who live in your county and see if you can come up with some ways to tax them. You know what I mean?
Yeah,
that put us all in prison.
People will, you know, some people that aren't particularly astute about what's going on in the world might listen to that and say, oh, no, that will never happen. And yet, we have no idea what they're really doing behind the scenes. I mean, we're only seeing the very tip of the iceberg from even what we're getting from Snowden. And from that, we know that, you know, these guys have spied on their girlfriends. So if they spied on their girlfriends, what's to stop them from handing it over, you know, like you said, to the sheriff department or, somebody's got a political grudge against somebody else or somebody says, you know, that Mike Meharry over there at the 10th Amendment Center, he's a little bit of a troublemaker. Let's see what we can dig up on him. Of course, they're not going to find much because they don't have time to get into any kind of trouble. But, you know, I mean, it's the possibilities of this are really pretty astounding when you get down to it.
All right, now here's the thing about the 10th Amendment Center that I like, that unlike me, you don't just sit around complaining about it like this. I mean, we had to start off the show with complaints because it's important. We got to set the context for what we're talking about here. I mean, they have permanent records of everyone's cell phone. Come on, whoever takes the battery out of their cell phone on any kind of top secret anything, you never do, ever. Hell, I got an iPhone. I couldn't even take the battery out unless I smash it with a hammer. So, in other words, they have a permanent record of all of our associations going back as long as they felt like. Everywhere we've been and who else was there this whole time. And all they have to do to be interested in it is to scratch their head and think about it. And then all I got to do is type a couple of keys and up comes whatever they want. I mean, you talk about intrusive. This fascia thing, this is probably, as far as I could tell, this is the biggest story out of this. Remember, they denied that they had location information. Dianne Feinstein tripped up and said, yeah, all we're doing is collecting your location and some other stuff. And they said, no, no, she was speaking extemporaneously. No, no, no. Uh-huh. All that metadata that they're getting includes where you were ever when you got up from your living room and went to the bathroom, as apparently, you know, in this data. They're just keeping all of it. I mean, holy crap, man.
Yeah, and, you know, it's amazing. And you get this pushback from people, and they'll say, well, you know, if you're not doing anything wrong, what does it really matter? And they forget about the fact that we live in a society that has literally thousands and thousands of laws. And I can guarantee you that probably everybody that's listening to this show right now or that will listen to it later has broken one or more laws today without even realizing it. So you've got this potential that they can track virtually every place that you've been and everything that you've said and every website that you visited and everything. There is a likelihood that you have violated some law along the line, and who's to say that that couldn't be used against you, again, for political purposes or, you know, who knows?
Yeah, or like you said, a personal grudge. I mean, everybody knows. They've written up stories like this all the time where more than half the 911 calls are just people angry at each other trying to get each other in trouble with the cops over, you know, the guy borrowed my wheelbarrow and brought it back a little bit bent kind of stuff. And just, you know, so people like that have government jobs, too. You know what I mean? Hell, we all know what world we're living in. Who our right. neighbors are sometimes, you know?
No, we know that all the NSA people are good, upstanding, would never abuse the power that they have.
They passed a background check.
Yeah. Oh, it's just absurd. The arguments that you get back are amusing. But, you know, it's interesting, in all seriousness, I'm hearing less of this type of, you know, I don't have to worry about it if I'm not doing something wrong. I'm seeing a lot more people that are normally not really politically aware, not really engaged in this kind of thing, mm-hmm. kind of perking up their ears and voicing some concern about this stuff. So, you know, maybe that's a good thing. Maybe that's a positive that's coming out of this, that people that might normally say, oh, it's no big deal, are starting to kind of go, oh, maybe this is not quite what we're thinking.
Right. And I think that's one of the things, and Greenwald has explained that he's sympathetic to the idea that people want him to come out with as much as he can, as fast as he possibly can. And he's saying he is, but as fast as he possibly can is like this. He's got to report it because of all of the different drawbacks, particularly for the government trying to claim that what he's doing is something other than journalism, but somehow just laundering intelligence materials or whatever they can to try to pretend that his journalism is a crime and that kind of thing. It seems like one of the benefits, maybe deliberately or maybe a side benefit of the slow leak, is that it keeps proving them liars over and over and over again.
Exactly.
Okay, well, we confess to this, but not that. And then, blam, they get smacked down again and again.
Right.
And, you know, Greenwald has talked about tens of thousands of articles. The guy from The Guardian, the Rusberger, the editor of The Guardian, testified before the House of Commons in the UK that they published at The Guardian, which had the lion's share so far, they published 1% of the Snowden documents so far. And maybe a lot of those won't be published because they have things that Greenwald has decided aren't really newsworthy, but are instead just would get people in trouble in a bad way, like, you know, information that could help the Chinese crack down on their own people better, but doesn't really serve
right.
any public interest, that kind of argument. But again, you know, they lied and said, no, we're not keeping your location. We don't care where you are. Oh, yeah. Oh, you got us again and again and again. There's so many of these. But anyway, I got diverted off onto that when I was trying to ask you about what the 10th Amendment Center is doing about it, because I think it's not just important that you guys have a history of success on some very important issues, but you set an example for other people to do entirely different things too, but to do something when you prove that you can actually get things done on an activist basis to oppose these very worst abuses. You know, there's no end of people knocking on my door trying to get me to give money to beg the local government to be more environmental or whatever crap, you know, but this is important activism. This is stuff that absolutely needs done. And at the 10th Amendment Center, you guys are doing it. So, you know, wreck them, man. Tell them about how powerful this movement can be against the National Security Agency.
Well, you're absolutely right. And I think the first important lesson that we have is that we can't depend on Washington, D.C. to rein in its own power. It's never happened. When it gets power, it keeps it, and it lets it grow more. You know, and like I mentioned earlier, it's part of the warfare state. And really what we have in Washington, D.C. in Congress is we have what I call the bipartisan war machine. With the exception of a few principled folks that are up there on Capitol Hill, most of them pretty much walk in lockstep when it comes to this whole idea of national security aggressive foreign policy and all of these horrible things that our government does in our name, so to speak. So we have tried to come up with a different approach. Forget what they're doing in D.C. Let's see what we can do at the state and local level to thwart what's going on in Washington, D.C. So we started putting our heads together, and we coalitioned with a number of other groups, and we started trying to come up with ideas. What is the Achilles heel of the NSA? What do they need? What can we do to kind of block and hinder and impede what they're trying to do? And it's a pretty cool coalition, too. You know, it's not just the Tenth Amendment Center. We've got the Bill of Rights Defense Committee, who's on board, a big partner, and we've got antiwar.com, who's joined the coalition, and Tangerine Boland's group is involved. And so some really cool people have gotten in on this and thrown their brains into this whole idea. And essentially what we've decided is we're going to come up with a state-level and local-level campaign, grassroots activism in each state to try to block what the NSA is doing. And kind of the first step of this process is this Fourth Amendment Protection Act. And it's a piece of legislation, and it essentially does four things. I'm going to outline them really quick. Number one thing it does is it prohibits the state from any material support of the NSA. Okay, what's material support? We've got this data center in Utah that's sucking up data. And we know that when this thing is fully operational, it's going to use 1.7 million gallons of water every single day, which is pretty significant in a state like Utah. You know, it's not like there's a lot of water there to start with.
Right.
So, you know, even from an environmental standpoint, this is a travesty. But the interesting thing about this is that the city of Bluffdale, Utah, has a contract with the NSA to supply them water. Well, the state government has control over its political subdivisions, which are the local and state or local and city governments. So the state government can say, "You are not allowed to provide material support to the NSA," and it will either invalidate the contract or, at worst, make it so they can't renew it when it comes up again here in a few years. So you've got this data center with these computers that are sucking up data. It needs all this water to cool it. We're saying turn the water off. And then let them try to figure out how to cool their computers on their own.
All right, but and now wait a minute, because this sounds like something that would be so cool if it happened in my imagination. But you're telling me that this is a real thing, really. And you know what? Yes, I'm bribed in the sense that the Tenth Amendment Center helps support this show. But obviously, the only reason why that's true is because of how bent we are the same direction on this, all
exactly.
This stuff anyway. So I'm not just playing a show. It's not a conflict of interest. It's an alignment of them. But, I mean, really, because I have trouble believing in anything, honestly. Man, I never did move to New Hampshire or any of those things. You're telling me that you could really, not just you got this great idea, wouldn't it be nice, but you can really find a way to make the government of Utah turn off the water to the new NSA treasure trove facility there.
We think we've got a good shot of doing it because, first off, at the grassroots level, like I said, when you start talking to people, nobody wants to be spied on. And as we've developed this coalition, we find that there's all these different interests. Like I said, you've got the environmental interest. You've got people on the left that are traditionally concerned about civil liberties and blocking the you know, the kind of imperialist war machine. But then you've got people on the right, and you know, maybe it's just because they don't like Obama, but for whatever reason, they're not real big on this stuff either. So at this point, we've got a coalition of people that spans the political spectrum. We've already talked to state representatives in the state of Utah, and We've got people that have said that they're willing to run this bill in this state. So you know what? We're going to go for it and see what happens. And that's not the only thing that the bill does. There's actually three other pieces to the puzzle. Number two thing that's going to happen is it would prohibit the state from using any of this shared data that we already talked about that's gathered without a warrant, without probable cause. It would be inadmissible in state court. And in fact, we've got a legislator in the state of Kansas that's already filed a bill that just has this one piece, the data sharing piece of it, and he's already got this bill pre-filed, so they're running with that in Kansas. Number three thing we've got 166 universities in the United States that have partnerships with the NSA. They call them Centers for Academic Excellence, which I think is a lovely Orwellian term. And essentially, they are recruiting grounds and research facilities for the NSA, 166 of them. Well, the state government can say to their universities, you know what, you're not going to have these partnerships with the NSA, and they have the funding strings that they can force that issue on the state universities. And then the fourth piece of the puzzle is it would prohibit any corporations in that state that are doing business with the NSA from being able to bid on any state or local contracts. And the really cool thing about this, you know, it sounds radical and crazy. Everyone wants to talk about these radicals. But the truth of the matter is we've done a lot of research, and this stands on very firm legal footing. There's a legal doctrine. They call it the anti-commandeering doctrine. I don't want to bore our audience with a bunch of legalese, but essentially, even the courts have held that the federal government cannot force state governments to assist or to help or to do anything to implement or execute federal acts or federal programs. So this is an established court doctrine. The state cannot be forced to help the NSA, at least from a legal standpoint. Now, you know, they could roll tanks into Utah and take the water, I guess, and then we have a whole other issue. But the idea is to do this not just in Utah, but in many states across the United States. You know, Texas isn't in session this year, but to do this in Texas, to do this in Arizona, to do this in all of the different states. So it's not just one state, but a bunch of states working together. And if one piece of the puzzle maybe doesn't fit, we've got all of these other pieces that are working together. On top of that, we're also looking at some other activism-type things that aren't really legislative, organizing grassroots folks, organizing people on campus, students that don't want their university to be part of a spy program, getting them active on their campuses, doing some stuff through outing corporations that are doing business with them and kind of embarrassing them and saying, hey, you know what, you're making money off spying on your fellow citizens. So it's really a broad-based, multi-year, multi-pronged strategy that we're looking at that we think at least has some hope of having some impact. And we have seen how state refusal to cooperate with the federal government has opened some doors in terms of marijuana legalization, medical marijuana. We're seeing some action in some other areas of legislation. So we think that it's going to work. And it also actually worked back during the early 1800s with the Fugitive Slave Acts, and, you know, piece of history that fell down the Orwellian wormhole. But northern abolitionists defied the federal government and refused to implement the Fugitive Slave Acts, and it was really very effective. It was so effective, in fact, that South Carolina complained about it when they seceded. They called it northern nullification of the Fugitive Slave Acts. So we have a blueprint where we've seen this work, so we're going to apply it here and see if we can make it happen.
It sure sounds like, well, it's the most important thing other than the wars, and it really, as you said, it's part of the militarism. It's just the domestic blowback. As Chalmers Johnson used to put it, you give up your empire or you live under it.
Exactly.
Fair warning, but that was a long time ago. Now here we are living under it. But, you know, I do think it's possible, and I think the mood is really shifting. As you said, part of it is partisan politics and all that, but of course, this week it was big news that the Pew survey, and they always look at the anti-war mood and they always smear it as isolationism, that even their spokespeople and their writers at the Pew Charitable Trust were forced by circumstance to differentiate and admit that, no, really, there's no such thing as isolationism. The people of America, in their majority, the highest numbers ever, want more international engagement on a private, voluntary level, business and any other thing like that, foreign trade and all of that. And they're more against federal government involvement in regime change and wars and intervention overseas than ever before. Both of those things at the very same time. And I don't know how long we can hold that, but man, that's the realignment I'm looking for. And I think, you know, it kind of takes living through George Bush and Barack Obama to bring us to this point where people are really willing to say that, like, man, wouldn't it be great if we could get the judge and Nader to stump for Paul and Kucinich and these kinds of ideas and, you know, realigning, well, that was mine, but realigning the different political factions around what our government has made the most important subjects, the foreign violence and then the domestic police state blowback that the rest of us have to suffer. Seems like it's finally getting through to people, you know?
And that's really what we're all about. I mean, ultimately, at our core, what we're trying to do at the 10th Amendment Center is we want to decentralize. We want to make the federal behemoth as little as we possibly can, and then we want the people to control what's going on at the state and local governments, because I don't trust state and local governments either. I mean, all governments trample on our rights. But ultimately, if we can get less centralization, that opens the door for more voluntary private exchanges like you were talking about. And that's really the end game that we're looking for.
Right. And, of course, the 10th Amendment Center, people should know that you guys actually have some really important victories in the past. Can you talk about that?
Well, you know, I think the biggest win that we've seen in this type of movement is what I mentioned earlier. It's the whole war on drugs and marijuana. You know, we had 1990s California basically said, you know what, we want to have medical marijuana in this state. And the federal government said, you can't do that. It's against federal law. And, you know, we had the court case, and they arrested this poor woman, Rach, and that went all the way to the Supreme Court. And, of course, the federal employees at the court said, oh, yeah, that's perfectly okay for the federal government to continue this war on drugs. And so did California back down? No, it just kept growing. And then next thing you know, now today we have 21 states with medical marijuana. We've got 2 states with complete legalization of marijuana. And, you know, really at this point, the federal government can't do a whole lot about it. I mean, you know, they can do some raids and stuff, and they will. They did it in Colorado the other day. But the funny thing about the Colorado raids is that, you know, it's the biggest drug raid in the history of Colorado since they had legalized medical marijuana, and they hit 12 dispensaries in Denver. You know how many dispensaries there are in Denver? It's 400. They hit 12, and it cost like millions of dollars, and it was this huge big deal. There is no way at this point that the federal government can shut this down. If the states and the people in the states decide, you know what, we're not going to follow this, then there's really not a whole lot that the federal government can do about it. And this is, I think, probably the greatest victory that we've seen in this movement. But we're working on this. We want to push this ahead, too, in other areas, you know, indefinite detention. You know, we've got the president and the Congress basically saying, oh, yeah, they can come throw a hood over you and drag you off to some unknown who knows where. Or, you know, who knows, you may end up in Somalia or something in some concrete cell.
Yeah, no, they really did pass that, didn't they? That's not just something that you're saying. They really did pass a law, the Congress, that the president signed that said that, oh, yeah, Americans can be subject to the Guantanamo treatment.
You're exactly right, and you'll tell Congress.
I'm just sorry, because when you refer to it like that, it sounds almost unbelievable. So I got to make sure people are, you know, snapping to and paying attention here. That, yeah, he just said that they did that, and no, he's not wrong about it. they really did do that.
I like to use the hyperbole for the visual purpose, but it's true. And you know, we even have a federal judge up in New York that looked at the language in this NDAA bill, the 2012 NDAA, and she looked at the language and she said, yep, this is overbroad, and she essentially ruled and said that this could apply. You know, you've got a journalist who's interviewing some guy over in Yemen, and some guy somewhere here in the Pentagon decides that this guy in Yemen is a associated force with Al-Qaeda. Well, all of a sudden, this journalist is now part of the associated force, and he's subject to the rules of war sitting in his office in New York City writing a story. And so I'm not making this up. I mean, we've even had a federal judge that has...
Sure, and a lot of people have heard of it, but I like to try to highlight the part of the thing where it's so run-of-the-mill now. There's so many outrages that people get kind of burned out, and they sort of forget that, oh, yeah, that NDAA thing. But now tell us quickly. We're almost out of time. You got 30 seconds to tell us about what y'all have done about that, and it really is something.
Well, they've got a bill that another piece of state level legislation that essentially says, you know what, this state is not going to cooperate with indefinite detention. You're not going to use our National Guard to do it. You're not going to use our police. And California passed this bill just recently. Alaska's passed this bill, and Virginia's passed this bill. So we've got three states that have essentially said, you know what, we don't accept this as valid in our state. And I really think you're going to see more pass in this upcoming legislative session. So we want people to think locally, think at their state government, and take action there. Don't call Congress. Work through your state legislature.
Great. All right. Hey, thanks a lot for your time, Michael. Appreciate it.
Hey, thanks for having me on.
All right, everybody. That's Michael Meharry from the 10th Amendment Center, offnow.org. Participate. Join the coalition. Help these guys to turn off the water to the NSA computer warehouse in Utah. See you in 2 weeks.